Hello and welcome to Board Stupid, the podcast that loves to talk tabletop board games, D&D and other awesome stuff. I'm Tom.
And I'm Simon.
We're just nerds talking about the things that we love that are worth geeking out over. Simon, are you ready?
I am.
Well, I'm ready. Good. So let's dive into this week's episode. This week, we're trying something new. As you may have noticed by the absence of Wayne, we're taking the proverbial reins, steering wheel and or rudder, and this week we're going to be talking about our top 5 games of 2023. Those that we've played, those that we've purchased, those that are not necessarily new to 2023, but new to us, and still worthy of recommendation, because after all, we only play great games. So, Simon, why don't you start us off and we're not going to run in a specific order, but we'll go 5-1 just to make it sound like we're counting down.
Yeah, you all know me. I break the rules as soon as we write them down, really. Yeah. These are 5 games I very much enjoyed, roughly in an order, but not really, because how do you rank stuff you love, right?
Well, I think given how many games we get to play in a year, taking 5 from those means we probably rank them all very closely together at the top of the list at the end of the day, and it's going to be probably quite difficult to differentiate between them.
Absolutely. So my number 5 pick, and that's actually one that you picked up, Tom, it's Planet Unknown.
Planet Unknown's great.
Isn't it good?
Yeah. I saw this at UKGE last year. There was like a preview.
That's right.
And a few people were talking about it, and it looked really, really interesting. And then this year, I managed to pick up a copy. And it's brilliant. It's a sort of a rearrangement of the Polyonimo formula slightly, right?
Yeah, it really scratches that tile laying puzzly itch that you've been playing since the early 90s with Tetris and similar, except it's got a whole bunch of other bits that go on top of that to make the game really exciting.
I mean I love a Polyonimo game anyway. I've got quite a few of them, but this one's great because I think my favorite thing about it is it's all simultaneous drafting and placement, so it runs super smoothly regardless of the player count.
Yeah, for a game that looks like it might be quite involved, it goes, I mean, I don't think we've ever had a game that goes more than an hour.
No.
Probably generally less than that, and that's even at its, is it 5 or 6 player count?
6 players, and that's sometimes with a teach as well.
Yeah, it's so cool. It's such a simple idea. You spin that very clever Lazy Susan in the middle.
Susan the space station.
It gives each player one of 2 tile options, which are in, as Tom says, these different Tetronimo shapes that you then choose to best fit your current layout on your planet map, but then also choosing which of the 4 or 5 different terrains you want and what bonuses you'll get from them. It's just so clever, and it really spoke to me.
Yeah, so when you place a tile, you get resources corresponding to the colours of tiles that you've picked. You may want to pair up your colours together to try and achieve an achievement, complete an objective, I think they're called.
Yep.
You may want to spread them out, or you may want to avoid certain colours, because there'll be various different objectives in the game every time you play that make it different. When you place the tiles, you get resources, you advance tracks, and then you get this nice little sort of combo effect where advancing one track triggers a bonus that then might advance another track that triggers a different bonus.
Yeah, that's a really fun turn when you place one tree down, upgrade your biome, which then upgrades your water, which then unlocks a rover, and then you're suddenly trekking all over the place.
Yeah, it's got this wonderful little rover driving mini game boiled into it as well, where one of the resources is rover movement. And the rovers basically drive around on your planet trying to rescue life pods and remove meteorites that stop you from scoring.
Unless you've got that thing which you get more money for having them. Well,
sometimes you want more. Yeah, sometimes you want more meteorites.
Loads of options.
Yeah. But you have to sort of avoid where you're placing... You have to avoid placing tiles on top of your rovers, because your rovers might be driving on and off of the existing tiles doing their own thing. While you're placing tiles, which is just weird and wonderful.
It's a great little puzzle game. Mm. A theme that you'll probably hear me going on about in the varying titles I picked today.
So the other thing that I really like about the game is it's got sort of asymmetric corporations, I think they're called. So you've got up to 6 players. Each of the player boards has another side which has an asymmetric corporation faction on it. And then each of the planets that you have has an asymmetric side as well, so you can mix and match them in loads of different ways.
I don't know if I've played with the asymmetric side yet.
So. I haven't. I've played Planet Unknown probably half a dozen times since I picked it up earlier this year, and I still haven't managed to get around to playing with the asymmetric corporations. Every time I play it, it's a massive hit with the people that I play it with. And then I show them the asymmetric factions and everyone's like, oh, we need to play it again.
Yeah.
And then I end up playing it with a different group of people. So I haven't had a chance to do so yet.
Well, the day is early, Tom. So perhaps
we may have a chance to do so.
We'll crack this out later on today.
Yeah.
And that's a title released from Adam's Apple, which isn't a company I particularly know, but good on them for that release. What is your top pick, sir? Or your number five?
So I'm going to go again. I'm going to go from the bottom up. But again, it's not in any real particular order. I'm going to start with one that I don't actually own.
That's fair enough.
It's a pickup that we've had as a team.
It's within the Bored Stupid universe.
Exactly. Our extended universe. It's Ikki, which is the Edo period Japanese shopkeeper simulator game, which probably at face value doesn't really have a lot of curb appeal. Or it certainly doesn't sound it when you sort of pull it off the shelf and have a read of the back.
Wouldn't be how I'd necessarily try and sell it to someone, no. I have to say, but you're not inaccurate.
No, but it lives in that same sort of niche like Smartphone Inc., where you know that you're going to appeal to people who like sort of economy games and worker placement games and Euro games and the various sort of overlapping spheres there. And it's a great little sort of tableau builder. It is worker placement, a little bit of worker placement.
Yeah, you've got three or four each season, is that right?
You have your...
There's the guy who goes around the market, and then the workers in each shop,
yes,
you can place
down to
activate
them. You have basically
them.
The shopkeepers. I can't remember the names of the pieces. You have the shopkeepers who work in the various shops, and you draft different shop cards of different categories and place them on the board. And you place them based on where you want them to be in relation to action economy. Because whenever you stop somewhere with your sort of your movement piece, mm-hmm. you get to activate either the basic action that's available to you or one of the shops.
Yep.
Or both, I believe. You can do both.
I only played this the once, so you'll have to forgive my lack of knowledge.
It's okay.
I think you can do both, or one comes at an extra cost or power or...
It opens up additional options.
The leveled up version, isn't it, mm-hmm. if there's a shop there.
And as the shops work over a series of rounds, the shopkeepers basically level up. They progress in terms of experience.
That's right.
And eventually they retire, like shopkeepers do, and the shop itself and the actions that are associated with it are removed from the board. They get attached to your personal tableau and they give you an income for the rest
like
of the
passive,
game.
Isn't it?
A passive
then?
Income
yeah.
for the
so,
rest
so
of the game.
So you might not get the most powerful version of it as a shop, exactly. but you get something from it for the rest of the game, which is equally powerful in its own
it
way.
It can be really good, yeah. I mean, there are whole, I suppose, colours, categories of cards that benefit the most from trying to get them retired as early as possible because they generate victory points for the rest of the game. If you take a load of brown category shops, I can't remember what the brown category are, but they just give you points. So if you get two or three of those retired early in the game and you just sit on them for the majority of the game, you can earn loads of points that way, just passively.
Almost like a set collection mini game
it is.
Going on
yes.
as well as the main board. And it's lovely production as well. We must mention how beautiful
it's
it
great.
Looks in its own style.
Yeah, so it's a point salad. You get points from the shops that you're placing. You're limited by the number of shops you can have out because you only have a certain number of shopkeepers. You get points from having, like you say, almost a set collection. If you have one of each of the colours, that gives you points. You get points for the various different sort of collectible.
Something about soup or fish.
No,
you've got
fish, so you can collect sets of fish that give you points. You can collect sets of tobacco and smoking pipes that give you points.
Right. Yeah, the pipes.
Yeah, so they all give you different points in different combinations. So there's lots of different ways to sort of progress through the game and score. But it's really clever in the way that you place or pick where your shops are going to go, because when you place them on the board, you're partially thinking about where you want them to be in relation to your movement piece so that you can get to them and potentially activate your own shops. You're partially thinking about placing them in a tempting location for other people to activate them, because the shopkeeper's progress and experience when other people use your shops, not when you use your shops.
That's right.
And you want to place them in such a way that they are at the least risk of burning down, because fire is a risk.
Of course it is.
And it's an interesting balance, because you have this firefighting mechanic in the game, and it's a bit of a all or nothing risk approach, right? If you don't invest in firefighting and no one invests in firefighting in your particular district of the board, there might be a fire and everyone's shops burns down, which has happened.
Yeah, I've seen it happen, and it's quite destructive, and yeah, not the best plan of action.
But you can hedge your bets. You might not invest in firefighting at all, or you might make sure that you always place your shops in a position that they are next in line down from someone else who has invested in firefighting, so that if they stop the fire, you don't need to worry about it.
They can afford you a buffer and a degree and then of protection.
And then you can spend your resources and your actions somewhere else in making your shops better.
It's a very clever game. This one released from Sorry We Are French, which is still my favourite games publisher name.
Yes, yeah.
Good choice, sir. I suppose I should give you my number four. And this one is a very new one to me. So much so that I will caveat this with, I've only played it a couple of times so far, but I liked it enough that I picked it up when I found it available, and I've really enjoyed it so far. And that is The Art Project from, well, it's Hachette Games in the UK, Lumberjack Studio.
So Hachette Games is one that I had not heard about until, I think actually until it was earlier this year when we came across them at UKGE.
We did. They had a big stand at
and
UKGE.
They had a massive stand.
They're essentially a localization partner / release studio for UK and Europe.
Yeah, they do distribution, for the most part, it seems to be, from American publishers who don't necessarily make it over to this side of the pond.
Yep.
They turned up with a massive catalogue of games, and the vast majority of them are basically republished or sort of redistributed under the Hachette Games name, so that we get access to them and we might not otherwise have access to.
Yeah, it's an interesting background in the industry that I still won't entirely understand, I have to say, because I kept getting confused between Studio H and Hachette Board Games UK. They're all affiliated in a sense, much like there's the umbrella of Asmodee also incorporates
sort of
slightly different
entities all within the same company.
Either way, Art Project, oof, what a blinder. This one came out at Essen, as far as I know, and sold out there. Tom, I'm not sure you've even played this one yet, have you?
Am I thinking of Art Society? I have not played Art Project. Tell me about Art Project.
So Tom has not played Art Project. He's played Art Society. So there's two big art titles released this year. And if you've watched Wayne and Matt's top five videos that they've done, Art Society, I believe, was very high up in Wayne's ranking. Art Project is the one where you are working as a team, a cooperative game where you are looking to recover stolen art goods from around the different locations of the world. You start off in Japan, or at least that's the recommended start location. Also got the US, somewhere out in the tropics somewhere. And each location gives you a slightly different challenge. The rulebook notes that it's not harder necessarily in any given location, but there's increasing degrees of complexity which might make it more challenging for certain players.
Interesting. That looks great. The art on the box is fantastic.
Yeah, I'm hoping to trot this one out again this afternoon once we're done with this recording. Visually stunning. I think it's great. It's Vincent Detrait, so no surprise there that it's incredibly visually appealing.
Yeah.
So yeah, you're working as a cooperative team, the Art Recovery Team, ART Project. Each city that you have in your country of origin is populated with a small number of white hands. They're the bad guys.
Okay.
And they are trying to...
The nondescript bad guy organisation.
Yeah. And I want to kind of align this with Pandemic in the way that each round, certain cities will grow in the number of white hands that are in them. And that's based on the cards that you choose to play as a team. You will know which cities are going to be populated because you'll be putting them there yourselves.
I like a game like that where you choose your own Jeopardy.
Yeah, you get a choice of two cards each person, each mm-hmm. round. Each one gives you a certain cost, so you have to get rid of some very limited resources. So you've mm-hmm. got gas, guns, and walkie-talkies. Some of them require some of your own very limited health as well. You'll then place hands in the cities that it tells you to. It might be anywhere between none and three, so some might go very quickly. And then you get certain benefits. And depending then on which order you choose to play them in, your fellow teammates will then play their cards and use perhaps some of the resources you've just picked up.
So it's crisis management, but in a sort of a way that you can predict?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're not supposed to just read out what card you're playing and exactly what it does. You're supposed to be kind of subtly communicating, like, oh, I might make us a bit, you know, I might improve our communications, but it's going to hurt me, means yep. I'll gain walkie-talkies, but I'm going to lose some health, you know.
Fair enough. It's going to cost me one of this resource for this.
Yeah, so it's supposed to kind of imply and insinuate rather than outright say. I think if you're learning the game, it's totally reasonable to just kind of
I guess it might make it too easy if you have several people at the table who can all sort of plan around exact numbers of resources.
That's it, yeah. Okay. But also on these cards, quite crucially, are different clues. So there's clue symbols. I think there's six in the game. So you've got things like sculpture or fine arts, movies and so on. And what you're trying to do is get a collection between the group of you of matching sets of three. So if you've got three clue cards that have been played that all have the fine arts picture on,
okay,
you can drop one of the missing art pieces into the city with the matching symbol.
So you may have to make your decisions not necessarily just on where the hands are going or what resources you're getting, but in order to complete sets.
That's exactly it, yeah. I might make this city really overrun with the white hands, but we'll know that there's art there. We can go and fight them. Fighting is interesting. Each player has one d6 that they roll to fight off the hands, and the hands power is a starting level of 6 plus the number of hands in the city you're fighting.
Oh.
So it starts kind of hard. You've got some caveats and ways of helping yourself out there. If you've got guns in supply, it's a shared supply, you get a +2 to your total. You can also have multiple people fighting in one city. So if you and I, Tom, were in the same city, we could both fight.
You can stack up.
Both roll our d6s and fight them.
Okay.
Every time you pick up one of the missing art supplies, it goes on the track that you are keeping at the top of the board, which pushes up the white hand's power. So by the end of the track, they are on 20 plus as a base level, plus the number of hands
you're
fighting.
Very difficult. Wow.
So
okay.
It becomes more and more difficult as you go.
Very much out of hand.
Indeed it can. But you can unlock ally dice. So these are generic black dice, which you can share between the group and can be used in every fight each round.
Okay.
And you can kind of bump up the skills there. There's lots of ways of kind of modifying your abilities. If you ever, at the end of a round, have five or more hands in a city, it's lost to you. You'll never be able to gain art from it. And also, crucially, you won't be able to move through it. So depending on the layout of this country you're in, you might be completely blocked out from the top.
I'm immediately
bottom.
Thinking that you said we start in Japan, which is long and thin.
Yeah, there is a circuit on that one, but the Egypt map is straight up and down the Nile. So if you get to one end and then the city below you is blocked out, you're going to be stuck there. So lots of decisions to be made.
Interesting.
There's
okay.
six different maps in there to start with, and I think that is a great... I mean, I picked this up for a bargain of £22 this week.
Wow.
That was on Chaos Cards, down from about 38, so I got a real steal. So do look out for it on offer, guys. It's a really good amount of game and a great puzzle as a co-op game.
I guess the question is, do you think it's got a lot of replayability with the maps?
I think so, yeah. As I say, I've only played this a couple of times. Had one success and one failure so far, and it was a very close failure. You kind of worked out that you can't actually complete because you have to play each player has to play a card, which depending on what cards you draw might cost you a resource you simply don't have to hand.
Sure.
If you don't have the specific resource, you can spend your health. But if you're also only on one health, you'll die and lose the game simply by spending it. So it's a really fun little puzzle challenge of working out. And I think you'd enjoy it, Tom, because it's got that kind of resource management and the crisis management,
I do like a crisis management game. I like having a crisis.
Yeah. So I think you'll help me get my second win when we play this later today.
I'll definitely give it a try. Lovely. Okay. Right. I'm going to jump straight on then. So I'm going to go with the Fox Experiment.
Hooray!
So the Fox Experiment is the next game from the maker of the acclaimed Wingspan. And It follows the experimentation on domestication of foxes in Siberia.
That's right.
Which again, I think there was some controversy around the theme, but that stuff aside, I think it's a great game.
Absolutely. I really enjoyed this one. Another one from Pandasaurus Games, which, you know, we're friends of them.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a dice drafting engine builder.
Suppose it is. Lots of dice.
Yeah, lots of dice. To things like Roll for the Galaxy, where you have an engine that you build up that will eventually give you access to more dice. More dice means you, when you roll your dice, obviously you get more access to more resources, and so on and so forth, and it sort of grows exponentially over the course of the game. There's nothing more satisfying than rolling a massive handful of dice, and they're like big chunky dice. They're lovely pastel coloured custom dice in 5 different colours, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, your 4 base colours and then the bright green wild cards.
Yeah, yeah. So 5 different sets of dice, lovely pastel colours. The pastel colours all sort of match with the theme of the foxes, the fox meeples.
That's it.
It's got almost gratuitously fox meeples in, I think, like 4 or 5 different sculpts.
There were 5 sculpts, yeah.
Which have no mechanical implications whatsoever. They just have given you a bunch of different
markers on
sculpts.
The board or on your player cards, and denoting that you've achieved a certain status. Yeah. Or
they're not even worker placements that you place very frequently. They're just used to sort of mark scoring areas. Yeah.
I think
really.
It's great. I love that kind of thing.
It's brilliant. It's a really, really satisfying mechanic of rolling dice. You get this sort of built-in additional, almost like a roll and write sort of mechanic, where you have wipe clean cards. So as you generate the resources from the dice that you roll, you record them on a card, and that becomes your sort of your fox progeny, right? The offspring of your previous generation of foxes.
You can kind of manipulate and optimize as best you can.
It's a game about domestication. So you are picking favorable traits that have been simplified down to colored resources, and you are trying to sort of build the best fox, so to speak. Those foxes then go sort of back into a pool and become the parents for the next generation, the next round.
That bit I found super interesting. You make this really cool fox, and then you almost immediately give it away and open it up to all of your other players. Yeah. You're like, I shouldn't make this as strong as I have, because now Tom's going to get 9 dice from it.
So, yeah, it's got some clever little mechanics for timing. It's got a sort of like an initiative tracker. So you could theoretically make sure that you pick your initiative position early in a round so that you're guaranteed to get the first pick in the next round if you think you're going to have a good fox that's going to go into the pool that you can then nab for yourself.
That's it, yeah.
But you do have to worry about inbreeding. So you can't have all your own foxes.
Yeah, it's probably not the best idea, let's be honest. It's not been an issue in the games that we've played.
No.
People are scrapped, because generally everything gets so good pretty soon. And it's only a 5-round game. I think that's important to notice as well.
It goes really quickly.
It's not one that's going to be, you know, you're not going to have to keep track of stuff over and over again. Everything's right there in front of you.
I played a very, very fast game of this at Spiel last year.
Hardcore blitz, yeah.
Me and Wayne and a very efficient German man. we blitzed through the entire game in about 45 minutes when they told us that we could have an hour and that we wouldn't finish the game in an hour. So we took it as a challenge. interesting, I don't think anything had changed in the rules for the retail version when it came out.
No, I'm from the bits I've read, I don't think there was any major changes there at all. It was a Kickstarter project, which, I mean, we know Elizabeth Hargrave is well-respected as one of the top-selling game designers of all time, really.
I mean, yeah, you cannot doubt the success of Wingspan and all of its expansions, right? Mm. So I really, really enjoyed Fox Experiment. I really want to play it more. Everyone that I've shown it to has really enjoyed it. And it's got a lot of the elements of Wingspan that I like, sort of with the not particularly complicated engine building, but satisfying.
I'd say it's a touch lighter than Wingspan.
Yeah, I think so. There's probably a little bit less decision making space because you are doing the dice rolling rather than drafting from a big deck of cards, I suppose.
Yeah, I think up to a point you can only deal with the dice that you've rolled, right? Outside of those occasional manipulations
there's some re-rolls, there's some additional like half symbols, there's some wild symbols, those sorts of things, right? So you get some manipulation, but it's relatively simple. It's not a heavy game by any stretch of the imagination, but it's really good, and it's a great hour-ish.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Mm. I've not got it on my list. I was pretty sure you would, so
Absolutely. For
the sake of differentiation, if nothing else, I've not put it on. But I will stick with Pandasaurus Games for my number three, which is the ever-so-simple, ever-so-clever Beacon Patrol. I really enjoyed this title. It is yet another tile-laying game, which I am super enjoying at the moment.
When I sort of saw this the first time round, I was taken with the artwork, but I was like, okay, doesn't sound that interesting. Like, there's not a lot of co-op tile placement games that are entirely friendly.
Yeah.
And it's that.
I can't think of another game like this, honestly.
It's a really chill little co-op game where you just play against, you're just playing against the stack of tiles, which is a timer.
Yes, yeah, once the tiles are gone, that's it. So it is just how well can you explore? And it's as simple as it looks. You place a tile within the very simply limited rule set. You know, you can only explore off the water edge to another water edge.
Which is nice and straightforward. But then it's a little efficiency puzzle.
You've only got two or three tiles to choose from each round. You can switch one with another player once per round if you're playing with multiple people, that might give you more options. And that's pretty much it. You're looking to surround each tile on its orthogonal faces. So if you've got a tile with a lighthouse on, you want something above and below, to the left and to the right, that tile's going to score you 3 points. But doing that isn't necessarily as straightforward as simply plonking
the
tiles
down. Yeah, because you might pick up a tile and it's got three land sides and it's just like a little cove, right? And then you're like, this is a dead end. And I can't place it here because there's another one next to it that wouldn't be a legal placement.
Yep.
And I've only had these two or three tiles to pick from, so I can't go this way at all.
You do get a couple of little movement tokens, which you can putt your way back out of those coves if you need to, but
you can't place the tiles freely, right? You can only place them next to where your actual boat is.
Yes, off a water edge of where your boat currently is. So if you are in a cove with land on three sides, you must only go off the open water edge. It's a deceptively not complex puzzle, but to get the best out of it, and you are just looking to get a better score than last time.
Yeah, it sounds very simple on the face of it, and when you sort of describe the game, I was like, that's not very difficult. And then you start playing and you're like, oh, my boat's in the wrong place, or I don't have the right tile, or I could get a tile if I trade with Wayne. I need that tile, but then he's not going to have a tile that he can place, and he goes after me.
Yep.
And I'm like, okay.
I played a game, and the person I was playing with, we switched back the same really awkward tile about a dozen times before one of us finally went, I can put that down at last. Yeah. But you just switch the same awkward tile back and forth. Yep. I think that's reasonable. Lovely designer as well. We met him in Essen this year, had a quick little interview. So if you want to have a quick look at that on our YouTube channel, go ahead and log in there. There's plenty of videos to see. All of our stuff from Essen, and Wayne and Matt have been going crazy with the videos recently.
I think we've also talked about this one more at length as well.
We have got a podcast episode on this. So go and have a listen if you want to hear more in depth. But yeah, great design, both visually. The same guy, Torbin, did the artwork as well as the rule set. He's also got it available now online through Steam, I believe, so you can play digitally.
Yeah.
And I think it's a perfect kind of game to just fanny around for 20 minutes on the bus.
It's one of those little sort of like solitaire games that I can see taking off and being really popular
in a
digital format.
It deserves it.
Yeah.
All right, so what have you got for
Lovely.
Number three?
Okay, I'm gonna have to skip over my number three because my number three was Planet Unknown.
Oh, okay. You did go rather in depth there on the when I brought it up to start with,
that's okay.
Fair enough.
That's okay. We've talked about Planet Unknown, and I'm dying to play it again and see more of the asymmetrical side of Planet Unknown. I think
that could really open
corporations up. And the different planets could make some really interesting combinations.
So they've got different tech tracks, or the way they score or level up is
completely different. So there is, for example, one that has links between the different resource tracks. So rather than going just up, you can go across with your cubes between resource tracks.
Place biome and upgrade water or something?
No, your progress basically can jump from track to track, like across tracks. Yeah,
okay.
It's really weird. You get some that have more or less rovers. I think there's one that has one rover, but it's like a super-powered rover and has a bunch of additional abilities and can teleport around.
I want it. Yeah, that's mine. Called it. Yeah, having that one.
There's some really interesting sort of additional mechanics by the looks of it with the corporations. And then each of the planets has sort of like the basic side, which is fairly straightforward and is the same for everyone. If you want a level footing, or you've got a bunch of asymmetric planets that have all different sort of passive effects on them.
Okay, I was going to say, is that like restrictions on placement?
Yeah, there is. So there's one that has, for example, loads of water and tiny islands, and you're not allowed to place water tiles unless they overlap onto the island.
Because
normally you can only place water on water tiles.
Yeah.
But you have nowhere else to place the land side of those tiles except on these tiny little islands.
Oh, jeez.
So you're quite limited in like how you sort of build around these little islands.
I think I'd both hate and really enjoy the limitations depending on how well I was doing.
I think there's another one that's sort of split into quadrants. And you're not allowed to overlap between the quadrants, and the quadrants have to specialize in different things.
Ah.
So, yeah, I can see them some of them being really tricky, and I can see some of them would probably synergize more or less well with the different corporations.
Yeah.
But I like the idea that you would have to make more decisions about what you're picking from Susan, from your tiles, based on, you know, what special stuff your corporation does or what your planet requires. Because the basic version of the game is relatively straightforward. You just pick a tile, you're trying to maximize your score, you're trying to avoid meteorites. There's plenty to think about already, but there's some great additional mechanics, I think, there that I'm really keen to explore.
Yeah, that sounds really good. And there's a add-on to this coming out, right? Supermoon?
Yes,
right?
I think it's an expansion. So when it came out on Kickstarter originally, there was a deluxe edition, and the deluxe edition has some additional planets and it has an upgrade of all of the wooden pieces to plastic. But to be honest, I prefer wooden meeples
for the most part. Yeah, I quite like the contents of this one.
And I feel like there's plenty of content in the game already.
Absolutely.
And, you know, having played it a bunch of times and not actually even used any of the asymmetric side of any of the corporations or planets, hopefully that's a good sign. But there's more content out there, and it sounds like there's more coming, which I'll certainly be keen to have a look out for.
Yeah, very good. Do you want to go to your number two then, or shall we swing it back my way?
You go, and then we'll finish it on number one together, right?
All right. My number two then, we are returning to the alternate history 1920s of Scythe for the sequel known as Expeditions. I was going to say Stonemaier's big release of the year, but actually Apiary was also released at Essen near enough at Essen. To great acclaim, but
I haven't had a chance to play it yet.
I've yet to play Apiary either.
Great.
I'm sure if I had played it, it might well feature in place of this.
I think there's at least one copy floating around in the periphery, so
one person at the games club that we go to on a Monday has this, so we'll have to bargain with them for a borrow or a bring it and we'll play
it. Bring it
and
play.
But yeah, Expedition. So we're back in the world of Scythe, so that kind of creepy Cold War-esque giant robots, but we're not really fighting.
Steampunk Cold War mechs.
That's it. Now, Tom, take that, move it to the colds of Siberia and add in meteorite crashes, which may or may not contain Cthulhu-esque other worlds.
Yeah, it's a sequel, right? It's not the same game.
It is not the same
game.
Doesn't
work the same way.
Nope.
But it's set in the same universe. It's a continuation of the same universe.
We're in the same world, yeah. So there's familiar themes. There's some familiar mechanics.
Some of the characters are the same.
Absolutely,
so,
yeah.
Like the faction leaders from Scythe are the player characters, if you like, this.
Yep, and they come with their animal companion, as before, both of which offer you, as their playing cards, very specific and powerful game options. It's essentially a cross between an engine/deck builder and a worker placement game.
Yeah.
The workers, though, interestingly, go onto the cards as you play them. So you're moving, you're exploring the 20 hexes that are randomized as the game setup board. You're then playing a card from your hand. You only start with the two, your main player character and their companion animal.
Yeah, so they're sort of unique to whichever player, whichever faction you pick.
That's right, yeah. They'll do roughly the same thing, but slightly different. But then at the bottom of each card, and you'll pick many more cards up throughout the game from the game board, they've got a powered up version, like a secondary action, much like the bottom row action of Scythe. But you can only activate that if you've got the matching coloured worker meeple, which you pick up from one of the on-board options. So if you move to a certain space on the board, you choose the gather option, you might get to pick up either a yellow or a green worker.
Yeah, you sort of gather the workers like they were resources, right?
That's it.
But they come in five different colours.
Yeah. Each will work on different types of cards, and the kind of themes. So the purple ones will do slightly more mystical stuff, and the yellow ones maybe more to do with other resources, and the green one maybe more to do with coin management. I can't actually remember the specifics of it.
If I remember rightly, the colours sort of roughly align with sort of like the resources in Scythe, right? You've got like metal, wood, whatever it was, metal, wood, grain, and oil.
Yeah,
right. They've got kind like, of they're like different categories of technology almost.
But you can get these great cascades of play this card, and if you play this card with this worker, you can also play another card. So you play that card at the same time, and then it says, oh, if you play this second card with a green worker, and you happen to have the green worker, you can recover one of the cards you've played this round. So you pull back that first card, and then you can do the same again next round. So you're playing two cards every round.
Yeah, and eventually you sort of you either run out of cards or you run out of workers, and you have to sort of recover everything back.
Everyone comes home for a rest, so all your cards come back to your hand side of the board. All of your workers come back onto your little player board, and you've got those available to play in whatever aspect you need. And you can then also reset your options. You've got this little option cube which blocks one of the three options. So you either move, gather, or play a card. You do a combination of two each round.
Oh, that's it. Yeah.
The exception being if you've rested on the previous turn, you then get to do all three, so you can move somewhere and gather and
play. You're not necessarily penalised too heavily for having a rest round. You get a little jump start to get back into the
sort of the
flow of the game.
There's some timing of it that you'll be desperate to not rest because you want to get somewhere faster than someone else.
Yes.
And then other times you're like, oh, if I do, I'll then be able to do this whole combination of stuff on my next turn. So again, it's that great thing that we love.
Setting yourself up for a hand-building combo,
right? Lots of combos and lots of clever little puzzles of how can I most maximise and optimise these sets of things in front of me. Doesn't play in too long a time either for what looks like a potentially complicated, complex game. It's, I'd say, a touch easier than Scythe in terms of learning it.
There's less setup as well, right?
Yes and no. The hexes don't take too long to set up. I'd say they're kind of grouped into south, central, and north. As you get north, they're more complicated.
Yeah.
And the corruption which is placed on them as you explore gets harder to vanquish.
Yeah. What I mean is Scythe has a lot of moving pieces. Scythe has a lot of resource management. Scythe has a lot of individual sort of components for the players. Whereas Expeditions, you start with very little to sort of juggle around.
Correct.
You set up the board, and most of the stuff then that you're gaining over the course of the game, you're just taking off.
It comes as it comes. Yeah. You're not having to look after vast quantities or keep track of it on the board like you do with Scythe. Oh, well, have I got enough oil to do this upgrade? Well, I've got meeples here, and I've got meeples here, and I've got a robot over here. It's a bit more straightforward, although there's a different kind of approach to it. But I was super excited for this to come out. There's not been many games where I've seen them announced and I've immediately been desperate to play it in quite the same way as I did Expeditions. I've only picked this up in the last week or so and managed to get it.
Well, for me, it was the, you know, it's the curb appeal of Scythe. Knowing that the Scythe art style and universe is so sort of unique to the game itself, right? And
I
then
think
saying,
it's really
there's
iconic.
More
yeah.
of that. And you know, you've got the lovely art cards on Scythe for all of the like the little events, discoveries.
Yep.
So all of the full-size art cards, the discoveries, all of the player boards having all of sort of these unique art on them. There's loads and loads and loads of this really, really tantalizing, weird steampunk Europe.
It's almost unsettling, but also incredibly intriguing. Right. I just want to explore.
I really like the idea of that setting. Give me more of that. I don't really care what the game is.
I
haven't had a chance to play through the game in full properly yet. Looking forward to doing so. But we did get a chance to play it very briefly. We got at UKGE.
Very limited, limited time there.
But what I saw, I liked. To be honest, for me, it's mostly the look of the game is enough to draw me in to give it a chance.
Well, it's coming out once we're done recording, so look, lovely. Get ready.
Am I right in thinking it has a one player? Does it have an automa?
It does have an automa, yeah. As with pretty much every Stone Meyer game, you can sit here solo. From what I understand, that basically drives another mech around the map, potentially getting to those discoveries
sort of
before
area
you.
Denial.
Yeah, because no more than one person can be on any given hex, and you need to get onto certain hexes to boast about your achievements.
Yeah, so it drives around and denies options.
Yeah.
Well, fair enough. But cool.
Yeah. Lovely. Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, okay. All right. My number two then is I'm going to go with one that I probably wouldn't have picked up myself and didn't really think an awful lot of until we'd played it.
Okay.
It's Big Boss.
Aha.
Yeah. So I'm going to be absolutely fair. This was one that Funko gifted us.
They did. Very generous of them. Thank you to them.
Actually, we got a copy of it before it was released. So we had a chance to play it.
Their version of it.
Yeah. Sorry. This is the 2023 version of a 1994.
As far as I'm concerned, this version's the only one that matters. Who knows about stuff from the 90s?
Exactly. It's... Well, it's actually a remake of an old game that was inspired by an even older game.
Which was Acquire.
Acquire,
from the 80s, I think.
No, I think it was earlier than that.
But
yeah, so it's a game that's sort of gone through a couple of different iterations. It's been redesigned, re-released, and sort of if you have a look at it, it doesn't look terribly exciting from the back of the box, but it's got this sort of interesting verticality with all the plastic pieces as you build like a little skyline almost.
It's a curious looking game in a way.
And we got it out when we were at one of the shows. I think it was when we were
Expo.
Yep. And played it with five of us.
Yep, you, me, Wayne, Ben and Ant.
Yeah, and it was brilliant.
Party time.
It was really, really good. And it was so unexpectedly good that I'm so glad that we picked up more copies of it. I think we've got like four copies of it floating around now. But it's really simple on the face of things. It's just... You do one of two things. You're either placing down a card with a number on it. There's only one copy of each number in order to either grow an existing corporation or found a new corporation on this sort of snake-like track which loops around the board.
Yeah, so each card represents a numbered plot on the board, effectively, doesn't it?
Yeah. Or you're buying a card from an open market, which will be one of the numbered cards. So there's some interesting decision space in that you have to try and potentially think about the cards that you might want to grab, either for yourself to build on an existing corporation or to deny them from other players or whatever later in the game.
Yeah, so you can kind of collect a run of three, four, five or
something. You want to collect certain cards together or grab cards so that you know that, you know, other people won't be able to expand corporations in certain directions, those sorts of things. Or you are investing in a corporation. And when you invest in a corporation, you grow a corporation or add a new one to the board. You also get an opportunity to buy shares. And at the end of the game, the only thing that's really worth points is your... Well, it's not right. You are basically... scoring based on your money at the end of the game. And the vast, vast majority of your money will be because of shares.
Yeah, it's an odd one. You don't... I think we said this in our coverage of it in our last podcast. You never own anything other than your shares in any given company, but you don't own the company.
No, it's one of these...
You might play a card and increase one of them, buy shares in another one in the hope that they then take over the one you've just increased, which will give you more of a payout.
Yeah, it's got a lovely...
And you just hope you have more shares in it than your opponent does, or they'll get more of a payout.
For me, it's sort of like a weird dissociation. You put down a company and you go in your head, okay, that's my company. But it's not your company. You just helped found it.
I founded
and
Regency.
You might get some shares in it, or you might like never buy any shares in that company or never invest in that company again for the rest of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And actually you go and invest in different companies. You don't own the companies. The companies are doing their own thing. They will grow. And you get to help manipulate how they grow and merge.
Yeah.
And the mergers are the most interesting part of the game, because when mergers happen, and it's all about timing, the smaller company basically will get eaten by the bigger company, and you end up with one massive corporation afterwards. The smaller companies shares all sell out. So if you've been buying a load of shares in a smaller company, hedging your bets, knowing that it's going to get eaten, you get a load of money, then you can then reinvest somewhere else.
Yep.
Or if you're the bigger company, your shares in that company suddenly skyrocket in value because you basically add the two companies together afterwards. And it sounds super simple when you're sort of explaining it to someone. It's just place some towers, build a little stack of skyscrapers, which is really satisfying.
It is.
And buy shares. And then at the end, and then as you're sort of going through the game, you're like, actually, I need this number, but I know that someone else bought the number next to that, so I can't grow in that direction. And I could block this thing over here, or I could stall for time by buying cards instead of investing, or I can grab shares. It sounds simple, but it's got so much sort of decision space. It makes you feel like you can play it a load of different ways and be... It's one of those games that you can get better at by recognizing when is a good time to sell shares or buy shares or plan your mergers or hold it's cards quite and stall.
Quite organic, I think, in the way you learn how the game operates, because I still don't feel like I fully understand it. I said as much in our main We Played podcast of it, but I think anyone can play it because it is so simple to pick up, and then you do just get a feel for... Maybe I will invest in this company, and
you can
hedging your bets on the stock exchange.
You see the merger coming. Yeah. They're like, those companies are close together, and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to try and subtly manipulate the smaller one to be the bigger one because I've got more shares in that one. That's the one I want to come out on top.
Mm.
Really interesting. And
but all the while, no complex machinations other than buy shares or don't expand the company or don't.
Exactly. And It's got a lovely art deco art style to it.
Very beautiful.
The corporation shares have these sort of like lovely sort of picture cards, and the individual cards for the numbers of the track are all unique.
Yes.
And there's 80 of them?
72 basically individual pieces of artwork.
And they go like in a rainbow, right? They go all the way through like a rainbow of colours.
I think I said again in the main review, they're kind of like advertising from the 20s and 30s. These big, I can imagine those giant banners and posters and billboards with ranges of companies from chocolate to manufacturing to all sorts. Really appealing. Really appealing.
It's great. I really enjoy it, and it's a much better poster child for capitalism than Monopoly.
This, by all rights, should kick that one in the can. It's just impossible to escape that game, isn't it? Even now, as much as we're trying, Tom, every discussion, every podcast, every post on Instagram
is
a fight against the Monopoly.
There you go. Big Boss. I really like Big Boss.
All right. Does that mean we're approaching the end?
I think this is your number one, then,
it is.
Right?
Okay. This might... I mean... Tom can see the game on the table, so it shouldn't be a surprise to him. It might be a surprise to some of you guys, though, listening, because you may never have even heard of this one, which is fair enough, but I think everyone should give this game some due notice, and that is a self-published title of Gigawatt. This was kickstarted last year. You will have heard me speak about it before on previous episodes. Delivered in around December of last year. And as we said at the beginning, this is new to us, and for me, I didn't really play this until this year, so I'm taking it. And
no,
what are you gonna do?
I don't think we did. You play it before we played it? I think we played it in the summer.
No, I don't think I did.
Right?
It took me took me a bizarrely long time to actually get it to the table for whatever reason. But I have played this a bunch now. I've got a copy in work. Those of you that don't know, I actually work in the energy industry, and this game is centered around that. And you might be saying, Simon, why on earth are you having a busman's holiday playing games about your work? But it is so satisfying. It is an economy game with some really clever little touches. And Tom, you've played this one with me once or twice.
Yeah, I was going to say, the thing that sticks in my mind is the two meeples, the plug and the socket that fit together.
Yeah, very satisfying.
Really satisfying.
So the basic premise of the game, for those that don't know, is every person represents an area of Europe looking to adapt their energy industry away from fossil fuels and keeping themselves going with renewables. So you start with two coal, two gas-fired power plants, generate you a certain amount of electricity each round, and that will match your demand at the start of the game. But what you're trying to do is close those plants down and then replace them with wind, solar, hydro, or possibly nuclear or biomass plants.
Mm-hmm.
each of which generate their own amount of electricity. But each time you close a power plant down, you'll lose as much as you've maybe gained that round.
Yeah. So it's always striking a balance, right? You can't, as in real life, you can't just turn off all the power plants and expect everyone to switch over to solar power, because it's not enough.
You can't say coal is bad, we'll stop using them, and then everyone sits in the dark, unfortunately. So what you need to do is absolutely strike that balance of build enough to keep the lights on whilst being able to slowly close down each round one of your power plants. Problem is, the demand is ever increasing as we get later, and the score track, or the demand track, basically represents a timeline approaching the 2050s.
Yep.
And I don't know about you guys, but I found I'm using more and more electricity as time goes on. I get more and more devices. I've got laptops and microphones and TVs and Xboxes and all the sorts. And as the game goes on, your demand will increase and increase and increase. And in fact, it'll multiply, because after a certain point, you'll be rolling two dice, or then maybe three dice.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting emulation, right? The demand goes up exponentially, right? Yeah. You have brackets where you go from one dice to two dice to three dice, right?
Yeah, yeah. As you move up in the phases, you can get slightly better equipment, as it were. So in stage two, solar panels become available. You can upgrade your wind farms or your hydro plants.
Yeah, you make them more efficient, right? They have better production.
They are better production, that's it. And with wind and solar, though, and this is one of the things that really cracks me up as a design element, but also quite true to life, and this game was designed by two Dutch gentlemen who work in the energy industry as I do. They've got a dice for each of them.
They're unreliable.
They are
unreliable. You can't rely on the weather.
So you might build a solar panel set that generates you six electricity, but if it's not sunny, you're only going to get half that power, which then, as Tom alluded to with the plug and the socket, your actual production rolls back for that round because it's not so sunny. So where you might think you're sat on just the right amount of energy for your demand, you suddenly find yourself wanting.
It gets quite difficult to predict. You've got to try and predict the randomness of the demand dice against a bit of randomness in your supply, depending on which or how much of a balance you strike with wind and solar in particular. You can go outside of wind and solar, but the other options either produce less power or are unreliable.
Yeah, or they
or
cost
are
more.
Very expensive, like nuclear.
So nuclear is very reliable, but at least twice as expensive as any other power plant for its space.
You've got these sort of two random elements, and you have to sort of guess where they're going to land in relation to one another and try and make sure that you balance out, because you want to balance, right? You don't just always want to have a surplus demand.
You want to be fairly level, yeah. If you can generate more than your demand, you will have a surplus, and you get a load of green cubes on your transmission space on your board. If you're not making enough energy, you get a load of red cubes, which is quite a scary thing to see suddenly dumped on. I played this in work once, and another guy called Simon was playing a very risky game. He ended up with 21 red cubes. He was so far behind his demand. It was ridiculous. The fact he hadn't managed to fail out of the game yet.
The first time we played, I think at the beginning of the game, what we had the neutral countries started with some additional supply.
That's correct.
Surplus. And then for the rest of the game, every single round, they rolled surplus demand.
Yeah, I think they always had a deficit, didn't they? But yeah, so that's one of the major phases of the game then, is if you do find yourself with either a surplus or a deficit, you can sell your surplus.
And try and push it to an adjacent region or sell it to an opponent, right?
Yeah, some of it's negotiable if you're trading with another player. Yeah. Otherwise, you get 1 giga money per transfer. Mm-hmm. You might need to upgrade your transmission line so you can sell or buy more from outside sources. But yeah, I think it's a really keenly balanced game where you can really feel the risk and reward for each different kind of option. Each area gives you a different speciality as well. So some focus more on solar panels in south or wind power in the north.
If you're in Africa, then solar panels are better in Africa, right? Because you're more likely to have the benefits for them.
But I think it's really clever. And then to close down a plant at the end of each round, there's a simple auction phase where it just goes round and round, like a bit like poker.
Yeah.
And the remaining people in that haven't passed just pay whatever their last bid was, and they have to close the plant down. As I say, you're immediately then losing your production.
Yes.
So you have to be wary that you're not suddenly falling behind.
You could play a very risky game and force the bidding high, knowing that you can't actually afford to close a power plant.
Yeah, one of the first things one of the guys in work said was, So I can just bid in the hope that you guys have to pay more and I don't have to close one.
Yes.
Yes, you could do that.
Or you could accidentally win and end up with a deficit.
It's happened. It happened in our last game, actually. I had one of the guys down from one of our other offices and he almost accidentally won a bid and then realised he simply couldn't catch. So he had to build a new coal plant just to try and stay. No. And then there's a taxation card. So you get a huge deck of tech cards as well, which give you some dice manipulation or mitigation or ability to sell outside your region.
They make certain types of technologies more efficient, so you're going to lean towards a certain path.
There's some really cool options in there. But once in a while, you'll get a CO2 tax card come out, which you immediately have to pay the fine on.
Yeah.
And this, quite interestingly, and I know it's not a fun thing in modern gaming, it's something that people don't really like. There is a chance of player elimination, but even with this particularly bad move from my colleague, still didn't manage to fail out of the game with
You've not had any player eliminations yet?
No, people have come close, but they've just ended up being poor, unfortunately, rather than being fully out of the game. But yeah, it's possible to bump out the game if you've gone so badly that you can't pay your taxes, but I've not seen it happen yet. And I think it's as a reflection of the kind of industry and what might happen. I think it's a fair thing, but I think it's a really, really fun game, a really interesting and different game. There's some parallels, I'd say, with Smartphone Inc. in the way the board's set up.
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of. It's a similar aesthetic, right? It's a similar feel.
It is on general release, although I'm not sure how frequently you'll see it listed on your main game websites, but you can buy it certainly direct from the manufacturers. So gigawattthegame.com, I think, is their web address. I find it super interesting, and for me, it's the game that stuck out as my top pick of 2023.
Fair enough. I think it's a good one. Okay, and my final top pick then is going to be Northgard Uncharted Lands.
Ooh, yeah, good one.
So Northgard is another game from Hachette.
Mm-hmm.
So they've imported it over from the States, I believe.
Oh yeah, I can see Studio H on the side, so that parallel there.
And this is a board game adaptation of a PC real-time strategy game.
Wait, we're playing computer games, Tom?
Yeah. So it's a game about a sort of semi-fantastical, vaguely Norse sort of clan game where you build little settlements and explore the lands around your settlements.
You have to survive the
winters. You can raid opposing clans, and there's a lot of sort of balance against elements and the animals and things like that. And this is a great adaptation of that game. Everyone that I've played it with who's played the PC game has gone, oh, okay, this is like that thing in the PC game, which is nice. But it's, even standalone, I think it's actually a really good game.
I've super enjoyed this one.
We sat down and sort of just, I played this on a whim at Games Expo, and as soon as we started playing, I was hooked. So it's got a really interesting combination of exploration and deck building. All of the actions that you take are through playing cards, so it's a bit of hand management and deck building. There's enough deck building to feel satisfying without it being too much.
Yeah, you're not over-focused on getting the exact right card.
You start with 7 cards in your deck, which is not many, and you'll only gain a maximum of like 7 more cards over the course of the game. So it's a small deck.
Is even as many as 7? I couldn't remember it being.
Yeah.
Is it 7 seasons, isn't it?
There's 7 years.
Potentially.
7 years, yeah.
Unless someone shortcuts it.
Yes. But it's really interesting. So there's enough deck building there that you get a bunch of extra options for the actions, and all the actions are the cards that you play. And then you have an interesting sort of territory control game where you're either moving your clans around on the board or exploring new areas around the board. So you build the board as you go, which I really like.
Yeah, that tile exploration is really fun because it's not just a case of flip the one that's there. It's kind of pick... Which one? Do you get one out of 2 each turn?
One of the factions gets to draft. You just pick one.
But then you can still choose its orientation.
You choose the orientation.
Which is really interesting. Yeah.
And it's really clever because every tile, although the tiles are all square tiles, every tile is split up into up to 4 small sections.
Yeah.
By borders that are drawn across the tile. And when you place the tile, it will continue or create borders from adjacent tiles and eventually complete regions. And you can have regions that span over two tiles, or you could have a region that spans over eight tiles.
Yep.
And that's one region as far as pieces and movement of your clans is concerned.
Yeah, it's a really interesting.
So as the game goes on, you can create these weird borders where suddenly you're adjacent to someone who seemed miles away before, because there's actually only one region between you.
You kind of creep around the edges of people, can't you? It's really weird. I like it.
So you get points for growing regions and doing exploration. You get points for collecting the resources. You get points for adding valuable cards to your deck. You get points for holding on to regions. That's the territory control piece.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just want to hold territory sometimes, don't you? But the bigger the region you make,
makes it
the
harder.
More appealing it is.
Well, yeah, and the regions, when they're bigger, are worth more points to complete as well as hold on to. They might also generate more resources. They might also have more spaces where you can build buildings in them to improve them even further. So you might end up with like a real sort of Goldilocks area, which has loads and loads of production in it. And then people go, actually, I'm going to come and steal that off you. Yeah, and they're all massing on your borders.
You've got two orchards and a lumberjack and a castle that gives you three victory points each round. I'm going to come and
And someone spent 3 years drafting cards that let them attack you, and then they turn up with all of their best attacking cards and their army of guys, and they take it off you.
And the combat's relatively simple. Number of people plus a roll of a dice.
Plus a roll of a dice for some randomization. And there's a few little extra tweaks, but it's generally fairly straightforward. You can sort of spend surplus food to make your warriors better, and there's a little bit of determinism in how the combat works.
Yeah, you can roughly know your opponent's stance and your own.
You can work out the worst case relatively easily. But it's quite interesting, because even if you lose combat, generally speaking, not that many people tend to die unless they've got nowhere to retreat to. And if they do retreat, they can retreat into any sort of adjacent zones, and they can actually retreat and split up all over the place. So you might go and smash an army, and then there's like five guys who survive from that army, and then they all spread out and take a bunch of adjacent empty zones, and then that player gets a bunch of resources from those empty zones that they've gone and claimed at the end of the round.
Fail forward almost,
sort of,
it?
Or fail sideways. All different directions. It's a really interesting retreat mechanism.
Yeah, it's interesting. And occasionally you might just want to get a couple of your people off the board because they're mouths to feed at the end of the round.
Yeah, you might want your people to die because you can't necessarily survive the winter. and because that is still a big part of the game, it's about surviving the winter. So you can't necessarily just build up and up and up, because eventually there's too many mouths to feed and you can't maybe produce enough food.
Yeah, it's so easily balanced, though. It might come across as a game with lots of things to keep track of, but honestly, it's not
so
accessible versus something like, I remember playing Palio with Wayne, and I was
stressing
about every little factor. This is so, I kind of want to say arcadey, which might stem from its game origins, that it's so approachable and accessible.
It's not a tremendously complicated RTS in the first place, and it sort of nicely emulates management of a few different types of resources. And, making sure that you've got enough food to feed all the mouths and roofs over the heads and that sort of thing.
Super enjoyable.
Nice.
Again, it's a game that doesn't hang around too long. It's about an hour's play, maybe.
I think it's 60 to 90 minutes.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think that's the kind of game length that we're after, mostly,
and
isn't
it's
it?
Got, it's
outside
got
of your Twilight obsession.
Yeah, everything seems like a short game compared to Twilight Imperium.
Indeed.
So it's got a few extra things in there that are nice to have. So like, it's got asymmetric clans. You'll always start with like a little passive bonus and a special card that goes in your deck at the beginning of the game that's specific to your clan, that sort of encourages you to play a certain way.
Yeah,
there is an optional module where you can add in the creatures.
Oh, those beasts are a
bears.
Pain in the neck, but a great addition if you're up for it.
Yeah, they run themselves as a neutral faction, but good lord, if you end up with some beasts on your borders and you don't have a good way of dealing with them, they can cripple you badly. Particularly if they come out early in the game have any warriors.
You want to farm this space, didn't I?
Nope, they're all
wolves. You want to move from this space? No, yeah. I don't think so.
Yeah, you're stuck. and in a way, it sort of like encourages you to then maybe lean more into the exploration thing or be more migratory, right? You might want to move.
It stops you just plotting.
I think if you don't play with the beasts, the game is much more of a sort of a static game, whereas if you do play with the beasts, you're forced to move.
Yeah, I suppose it makes it more dynamic, but a bit more complicated.
Yeah, you've got to try and find somewhere that has no beasts.
Yeah.
And stay away from them, because it's actually, I mean, you can get points for killing them, but they're actually quite difficult to get rid of.
They're tough, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really interesting. And there's also an expansion coming out for it as well, so I'm really keen to look out for that.
Ooh, yeah, I'm excited for that. I know there's a couple of small expansions already with the like the leaders pack.
No, that's one I mean. That's the expansion, okay.
Yeah,
so I'm keen to sort of look out for the expansion that has the leaders, and there's Jotun as well.
Okay.
The giants. So there's going to be more
get some giants on that
added
board
into the game.
Oh, now
yeah,
we're
yeah
talking, Tom.
Mm.
Good find and good pick.
I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, very, very, very good. Well, there we go then, folks. Our top five, Tom and Simon, of Board Stupid North, as we've been dubbed by our coastal
Board Stupid partners. Board Stupid slightly further north. it's not that far away. So, I mean, in addition to these five, Simon, are there any other, did you have any contenders, anything else that was close to making the cut?
I have two guilty ones that I fear may have been on the list if I'd ever got round to actually playing them, Tom. To say that I'm relatively restricted on my purchases, I'm sad that I've not got around to playing either of these yet. One is Turing Machine, which was super appealing to me as a based on the code breaking and all that kind of stuff, but just simply not got round to learning the possibly slightly complicated rule set. The other I picked up only recently at Essen, got a steal on it, couldn't resist it, Vital Lacerda's Bot Factory.
Yeah, I'm really keen to give that one a try.
I mean, maybe we'll crack that out in a bit, but I just haven't sat down and learned the rules
yet.
I punched the punch board, tried to
played a couple of his games. He's got a very distinctive, massive pile of pieces.
I think this is one of the more accessible ones versus some of the super heavy.
It's not on Mars.
No, it's not Weather Machine or Innovations or those grandiose ones.
Yes.
So yeah, they're my kind of guilty ones that I've not played. Other stuff that I've played and enjoyed, but probably only played once or twice and maybe didn't quite make the list. I mentioned a couple on Wayne's list. Art Society, I did really enjoy. That was the tile laying one from Mighty Boards. Very fun, very clever in the way it's designed there. Again, very pretty to look at with those pieces of art kind of mimicking, pastiching the classics. Also Haunted Lands from Ludus Magnus was
really
good fun.
I really enjoyed Haunted Lands. I really want to try it again. I think it was a close contender, even having only played it once, for sure. But it's not entirely dissimilar from some of the other games that I picked, so I sort of intentionally left it off for now.
I think that's fair enough. We do want to kind of represent a spread in a way, don't we?
Yeah.
A couple more that were kind of on the border of 2022, 2023. Orichalcum.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed that
one. Yeah, Orichalcum was great.
And Heat. I keep wanting to come back to playing Heat. I've not picked it up yet. I wonder whether I might, but I know that there's two or three copies floating around our wider group.
Yeah, quite a few people own Heat, so I've not bought Heat. Yeah, there's a few like that I've intentionally not bought, even though I really enjoy them, just because I know either you or Wayne or, you know, one of the guys at the club, they already own a copy, and I'm not necessarily going to play it with other groups.
Yeah, I played Distilled with Jason and James over at Meeple Minded. I'm not sure.
One I've been really keen to play. I've seen them playing it several times, but I'm always pre-booked.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. It's definitely your kind of game, from my understanding.
Okay,
good fun. I recommend that one. I picked up Cascadia Landmarks as well. Not a standalone game, so I thought I'd not put it on the list, but it adds a significant amount of new stuff to one of my
favourite. You've had a chance to play it now.
I've played two or three times, yeah.
Yeah,
and if you add in all of the bits, the new scoring methods and the new pieces, it adds a significant amount to what was already one of my favourite games of last year.
Is it more complex or...
It is, because it gives you a different decision space. Because when you would go to place the animal on the tile you've just laid, you can instead place the landmark token.
Okay.
Which will give you a different scoring method.
It occupies one of the animal spaces.
Yeah. Okay. So if you've got a space that you could put a bear on, or you could put a tree on, you might not be able to make your trio of bears on this turn, but you can complete your tree landmark and get points based on that.
So
It does add another layer on that kind of multi-leveled puzzle.
Interesting.
In a satisfying way, but yeah, kind of made my brain burn the first time I played. And even just the new tile designs, the way the territories are split on the new tiles means the orientation puzzle becomes that much more layered, and it's kind of fascinating how such a simple change can really make a difference to the way the game plays.
Yeah, okay. Any other old favourites resurfacing again this year? That was one I was thinking of.
Oh, no, do tell then.
Gaia Project.
Oh, yeah, you went on a bit of a run on that.
Yeah, which... So Gaia Project is one of BGG's heaviest rated board games.
Got its own gravity.
Yeah, pretty much. I bought Gaia Project a few years ago. I went into a shop with the intention of buying a lighter game, thinking at the time, I don't have enough games that occupy the 1 hour lighter game space that I can plug in between other games. Mm-hmm. And I came out with Gaia Project. Absolutely the other end of the spectrum. I'm not really sure what happened, but I really, really enjoy Gaia Project. It's a super, super crunchy, entirely deterministic Euro game.
It's Tom all over then.
It's basically Terra Mystica, for those who know Terra Mystica.
Is it in the same... See, I don't know either game particularly. Is it actually related, or is it just
No. It's essentially the same rules with a new skin.
Okay.
Terra Mystica now has some expansions, but at the time when they released Gaia Project was basically, they took all the rules for Terra Mystica, they reskinned it, and they added some additional sort of quality of life and sort of improvements over what they considered to be shortfalls on Terra Mystica at the time. And it's been, like, it was massively well received, but it does appeal to a certain niche, I think. Mm-hmm. Because it is a very, very heavy Euro game.
I've seen you guys playing it at the club, and it looks intriguing, but also I know what kind of games you like, so I'm a little intimidated, I have to say.
Yeah, no, it's very heavy. When I say it's entirely deterministic, there's no randomization in the game at all after the game is set up. You can see the ways of scoring at the end of every round and at the end of the game from the beginning of the game.
That sounds weird to me, but...
So every round there will be a certain way of getting bonus points, and at the end of the game there will be a certain way of getting bonus points, and you randomize those things at the start of the game and you see them coming. So you can plan your approach to playing the game to line up and synchronize with round bonuses and things like that. You can get extra points, and those sorts of things make all of the difference in the game, because it can be very, very close on scoring. It's got a load of different asymmetric factions that all play differently, which, you know, make the game even more complicated. And it's got no conflict in it at all.
That's interesting.
Yeah. The only interaction, really, that you have with other players is through denial, territory denial.
Yep.
If you beat someone else to a planet first, that's it. It's your planet.
Okay.
So they'll have to go somewhere else.
So that could, going back to that deterministic thing then, if you need a certain point of control that you
there,
lose
you,
out, yeah, that's it yeah. for the game? Does that not lead to diminishing returns for the rest of the game?
Potentially. You know, you might have a faction that very specifically wants to get a certain type of planet because it's easier for them to terraform those planets, and you basically have to pay additional resources if you want to terraform more difficult planets that are further away from your sort of home species planet type. But you can, at the beginning of the game, you can sort of draft your starting position. And there's a balance between wanting to be far away from people who might want to contend the same types of planets you want, and wanting to be near to people because you can get certain benefits from being near people.
Right.
Essentially, if people build stuff near you, you get some sort of incremental benefits from doing so, which sort of represents like little... It's like a representation of like little trade agreements between the factions.
I see. Sounds like one I'll have to explore with you in the near future then, Mr. Tom.
Yeah, it's great. It came up in conversation a few months ago at the Tilgate Community Club, and we ended up playing it, I think, about 4 or 5 weeks on the trot. I think at one point we had like 3 copies of it set up on 3 different tables.
Definitely
in
saw
one
two,
week,
two at once.
Something like that. Yeah, it was really, really popular, to the point where we overflowed onto additional tables with additional copies because there was lots of people wanting to play it all at the same time.
Trying to throw off the spreadsheet balance with Scythe.
Exactly. Yeah. Push it off the top spot. So I really, really enjoyed Gaia Project. It was one I bought a few years ago, but I don't get to play it very often, and having replayed it again a few times recently, it's shot right back to, you know, near the top of my list.
Excellent.
Great. Yeah. Okay. Anything that you're looking forward to in particular for 2024, now that we're at the end of the year?
Have you got some that are springing to mind? I know there's the new Nemesis Retaliation recently finished.
Yeah, I'm keen to see...
Absolutely enormous Game Found project.
Keen to see a couple of these that are coming out. I'm very curious about Fractal that Wayne's just received.
Yeah.
I'm really, really keen to play that.
Yeah, I'd like to play that.
I haven't had a chance to play it yet. I know he's only recently received it, but I'm really, very keen to give that a go. I like a big you know, space 4X-y style game. I have a few.
Just a few.
Yeah, so I'm very keen to see that. And there's a couple of others that I'm sort of keeping a vague eye on. I own a copy of Chronicles of Drenagor.
I keep hearing you talk about this, which, with Rob, and I'm curious.
Yeah, it's a Creative Studios game that came out ages ago, or a couple of years ago. It's a sort of like a three-dimensional dungeon crawler game, sort of Gloomhaven style, but it's got a similar action mechanic to, I think it's the Conan board game, where you use cubes to denote certain types of categories of actions by color.
I don't think I knew there was a Conan board.
There's a Conan board game. It's got a similar sort of feel to that. It plays like a dungeon crawler. Everyone controls one hero, sort of D&D style. You play against the game, so you don't need a DM for it. It's got lovely miniatures. And Creative Studios have done a relatively recent Kickstarter campaign for a reprint of the core game, right, which is massive anyway, and an expansion called, I think it's Apocalypse, which has the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
I mean, they're always a good addition to pretty
but
much any
they
game.
Some of them are absolutely mad. I think it's Death is like a rider on a massive dragon. And it's like a foot long.
Oh, jeez.
It's ridiculous.
So a competitor for the Tarascon painting over there.
I think it might be bigger than the Tarascon.
You're kidding.
Yeah. I'm sure there were pictures of it floating around at Spiel. So I'm sure we can find some pictures of them, but they just look absolutely insane. And I haven't backed it, but I was still vaguely considering it just because the miniatures for the Four Horsemen are absolutely mad.
That sounds like my kind of buying thing. Yeah. I don't really care about the game, but I was looking at Fateforge Chronicles of Khan recently.
Ooh, yeah.
I ended up not backing it in the end. I'm pretty sure Matteo has, though, so hopefully we'll be able to get down and give that a go. I might still get it when
This is the one by the same guy who did Vengeance, right?
That's right, yeah.
With not the Roland Wright, the original Vengeance.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, again, a dungeon explorer-y type thing, but with the dice rolling shenanigans of some of the Vengeance type mechanics.
Yes. Dice rolling and action allocation by custom dice, right?
Yeah, we played it a demo at Essen this year. I know you weren't there, Tom, but the three of us that were really enjoyed it. Like I say, Matt backed it. I missed the late pledge because I'm a dummy. I think I had about 4,000 other bills going out that week, so decided to hedge my bets, but it'll be coming to retail, so I'll get the non-deluxe version and sate my desire to play that.
Fair enough.
I'm sure. I saw Colossal Games, they of Western Legends fame, have got a couple of interesting titles coming out. There's one called Ruination, which I'm not familiar with.
The name rings a bell.
I don't know much more other than seeing the cover art here for Ruination Bloodsworn, which looks pretty damn cool. It's got this kind of cyberpunk with the Japanese style cultural add-on on top. Don't know anything about the gameplay itself, but it looks very cool. They also teased something for Q1 2024, which just looked like almost like a Red Dead Redemption Planes Rider, and no other information, so no idea what that's going to be.
Interesting.
Also been chatting with Max Kosek, who's one of the art designers for Mighty Boards and has worked on a whole bunch of really cool stuff. He's been teasing some information on his game that he's been working on called Heritage, which I'm not sure if you've seen anything on, Tom, but
I
looks
think
very
so,
interesting.
No.
Again, it's tile laying with varying levels of puzzle on top, but the scoring methods and the design ethos of it looks fantastic. So I'm going to show you a lot about that in a bit, including loads of historical figures. So he's got a whole bunch of people from like Marie Curie to old presidents and a whole bunch of stuff. And yeah, I'm really curious to see how he's going to let that play. So Max, if you want to show us some more in private, do send over some details or a demo when you've got more than your handmade prototypes. We'd love to see more on that. It's looking super interesting. And I think that's it for me at the moment, but yeah, we will look into doing maybe a full episode on upcoming 2024 releases.
We'll talk about upcoming projects. I'm sure there's lots of things that we're forgetting at this exact moment. That's fine.
And if you've got anything that you're looking forward to or want to tell us your top five of this year, then drop us a line in any which way you so choose. Instagram's probably the one I'm going to see first and foremost, or our Facebook page. Both can be found at Board Stupid UK.
All right. Thanks for listening to Board Stupid. Subscribe to us for updates and to get future episodes of the show delivered directly to your earholes via your favourite podcast service. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Board Stupid UK, BORD as well as on YouTube. If you like our content, do us a big favor. Give us a like, a follow, a subscribe, a five-star review, any of those things, any combination of those things, all of those things.
Send us some food via Deliveroo or I don't know.
And share the links to this episode on social media. We'd love to hear from you if you've got any feedback. Do please send us your comments, your questions. Stick it in the comments below. We'd love to hear from you guys. What were your top picks of 2023? Did you overlap with any of our choices? Is there anything, any gems that we've perhaps completely blanked and forgotten about? I'm sure there's probably loads.
There'll be one out there that people will be screaming like, how have you forgotten
this obvious thing that happened in 2023? I can hardly remember last week. I had a real hard time remembering five games.
you can see my notes. I've literally had to go scroll back through previous notes on Expo, look at my own Instagram feed to see what I posted about and go, oh yeah, I played that game in February.
Play a lot of games. It's difficult sometimes to remember which year is which.
And I know that I've missed a bunch because Matt was bringing out stuff to the table I've never even heard of, so... Let us know what you've been playing.
Anyway, thank you for listening. We'll catch you again real soon.